Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Harmattan Season by Tochi Onyebuchi. The book cover has a robed man with his back to us, looking up to the sky that has billowy, stormy clouds forming. He is looking up at the back of a woman seemingly walking up to the clouds. The reviewer is Matt Bell. Magic, conspiracy, and a down-on-his-luck detective. In Harmattan Season, the search for a missing woman uncovers a scheme that could change the fate of an occupied city in West Africa. Tochi Onyebuchi's latest novel, Harmattan Season, opens as many a detective story has, with a mysterious woman seeking the help of a downcast private investigator. In an early 20th century West African city, occupied by the French after a devastating war, we meet Buba, a cherché making a tenuous living finding missing persons. As a deux fois, half French and half indigenous Dugalan, and generally able to pass as either, he's living in semi-squalor in a city's ethnic quarter, saddled with unshakable debt, hiding his past fighting in the side of the French, and believing himself in possession of a permanent bad luck radius. When he opens the door to his mystery woman, she is clutching a bloody stomach wound and begging him to hide her. He shuffles her to a closet, and moments later the police arrive, saying they need to take Buba in for questioning. Under the guise of getting his sandals, he rushes back into his house and discovers the woman has vanished. Presented with such a mystery, what can a good cherché do but go searching? The case of the missing woman resolves quickly, but not before leading Buba to a larger conspiracy. As in prior noir-influenced science fiction slash fantasy fare, like China Mielville's The City in the City, or P. Jelly Clark's A Master of Gin, Onyebuchi employs the tropes of the detective novel not only to unravel a mystery, but also to trawl readers through an imagined setting whose inventions reflect real-world historical issues. In Harmattan Season, the deeper meditation is about the heavy cost of colonization and conquest. The woman Buba seeks turns out to be a floater, someone who can gain the ability to levitate after removing a particular body organ. This process is also used to create surreal explosives eventually employed in the novel's most indelible image, to lift much of the city's French Quarter, suspending broken buildings in midair, while their inhabitants tumble back to earth. This is guerrilla resistance fighting, not with guns, but with magic, as the Dugalan literally eject their oppressors from stolen land. Harmattan Season moves with a thrilling briskness, but sometimes its pace works against its other pleasures. Onyebuchi's West Africa is compellingly imagined, but the reader is so quickly rushed from locale to locale that one might struggle to stay grounded. Some of the novel's more intriguing characters get somewhat flattened by this haste. Most problematic is how Buba often feels carried along by his investigation rather than the driver of it. There's a lot of coincidence here, and sometimes characters seem to make plot-crucial choices without clear or pressing motivations. Like many noirs before it, Harmattan Season is about revealing the greedy schemes of the ruling class. Buba's efforts eventually uncover French machinations to influence a crucial election where, if the Dugalan reform candidate wins, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission promises to expose any number of war crimes, including Buba's own. If the puppet incumbent retains his post, the evidence of those atrocities will instead be hidden by lucrative building developments designed to house even more French settlers. To those on top, Buba despairs, the want for more of the same can justify any crime. Men like him, they get their money and their desire changes form, he laments. It's all about power. In the end, Buba's foes are not unlike the harmattan, a dry season of blowing dust Onyebuchi cleverly uses to evoke the ever-present despair of oppressive colonization. The Français, one Dugalan woman says, they are a harmattan that never ends. It's not easy to fight the wind, Onyebuchi argues, but it's not impossible. Maybe there is a way to change the weather. Maybe Buba can help bring the sweet rain the city craves, and with it, a new hope. The reviewer, Matt Bell, is the author most recently of Appleseed, and Refuse to be Done, How to Write and Rewrite a Novel in 3 Drafts. Never Flinch by Stephen King. The book cover has the Lady Justice statue holding scales up in one arm and resting a sword downward in the other. She is, of course, blindfolded, but her blindfold is red and has a red stream of blood flowing down her body in a thin stream. The reviewer is Ainsley Hogarth. A new Stephen King novel asks, does the world have heroes anymore? Never Flinch is a tale of stalkers and serial killers with a strong dose of social critique. When I received what appeared to be an email from a New York Times editor asking whether I was interested in reviewing the new Stephen King novel, it crossed my mind that it was a phishing scam. That Stephen King? Right, fella. I verified the sender, double-checked the email address, pasted an included link into a browser instead of clicking on it directly. Nice try, scammer. Several Google searches and redundant confirmations later, I cautiously agreed to take on the assignment, still certain the book would never show up as promised. When it did, I signed for it, wondering, had I been silly to be so suspicious? Or duly vigilant? As it turned out, Never Flinch, Stephen King's propulsive follow-up to his 2023 thriller, Holly, courts a similar question. Is the world totally fine, or is it in fact on fire? In the early pages of the novel, the brilliant but troubled private investigator, Holly Gibney, who appears in 6 of King's previous books, is just trying to enjoy some fish tacos with another familiar face, Detective Izzy Janes. Holly and Izzy are pals, a refreshing and distinctly feminine inversion of the usual animosity depicted between PIs and law enforcement, and Izzy needs help with a case. Someone has emailed the Buckeye City Police Department pledging to murder 13 innocents and 1 guilty to avenge a wrongly convicted man who was killed in prison. Does that make sense to you? The message reads. It does to me, and that's enough. Well, it may not make much sense, but the sentiment, this insistence that the invention of truth is an inalienable right, sounds painfully familiar, and it's not just the aspiring serial killers in our lives who are expressing it either. Before long, the mysterious emailer, who, like Holly, is plagued by the intrusive narrative of an abusive dead parent, starts making good on the threats. The murders are swift, unceremonious, random, executed with a chilling detachment that alerts you to your own infernal vulnerability. Even though bodies are piling up, the police chief has requested, no, mandated, that Izzy make time to promote and practice for the forthcoming charity baseball game against the fire department. A dog and pony show, as she puts it, prioritizing PR over catching bad guys. Holly sees something of a dog and pony show in a new client, the provocative women's rights activist Kate McKay. After several violent public incidents involving a Westboro Baptist Church-style stalker and another dust-up with problematic optics, the celebrity feminist male bodyguard beat up a female fan, Kate needs a new bodyguard for the last few stops of her sold-out book tour. Despite having no experience in guarding bodies and at first sight looking almost frail, Holly, Kate insists, is the right woman for the job. Woman being the main requirement, Holly grumbles. King returns often to this chasm between wanting to do the right thing and wanting to appear to be doing the right thing, or virtue signaling, as it's known online, where the scourge runs rampant. This overarching social critique works well to draw so many initially disparate threads together over the course of the novel, with short scenes bouncing among characters and locales. A structure that feels fun, almost retro. I kept wanting Catherine Bigelow's Blue Steel era sleaze to characterize the inevitable adaptation. However, in 2025, Kate McKay's Betty Friedan act feels a bit too out of step with time. How I wish a powerful feminist voice were filling arenas across the country, as Kate does. How I wish she were on the covers of magazines or had 12 million followers on Twitter. Instead, she's probably screaming into the void with the rest of us, watching in terror as the United States government systematically dismantles so much of what the real Friedan fought for. And maybe that's King's point. The world doesn't have heroes anymore. We're too busy with our own performances, hunting for skeletons in our would-be heroes' closets, in order to look the most informed. Kate is a sobering reminder that our big pictures, our most ambitious ideals, have become fractured, weakened, divided across billions of small screens, where indifferent algorithms dispense unwholesome rewards to content that sows discord instead of truth. In the cinematic style we crave from a Stephen King's novel, Never Flinch calls attention to the very real dangers of turning your convictions into accessories, exsanguinated by the impulse to broadcast them, of standing for nothing but your own image, satisfied by only appearing to have done the right thing. Thoughts and prayers alone won't fix our problems. They might even obscure how little meaningful action is being taken to fix them. The question remains, is the world totally fine, or is it in fact on fire? Seems like that's our new right to choose. The reviewer, Ainsley Hogarth, is the author of Mother Thing, The Lonely, The Boy Meets Girl Massacre, Annotated, and, most recently, Normal Women. Her next novel will be published in 2026. Parallel Lines by Edward St. Aubin. The book cover has multicolored lines bending in all kinds of directions and weaving through each other. The reviewer is Dwight Garner. Dispatches from the psych ward fuel this ebullient novel. Edward St. Aubin returns with a wide-ranging narrative anchored by a schizophrenic patient. My funny guillotine, sweet comic guillotine, he sings. Also, pill cutter, cut me a pill. And Senator Krupke, I'm down on my knees because nobody wants a fellow with a mental disease. This is Sebastian, the ebullient schizophrenic at the center of Parallel Lines, the new, uneven Edward St. Aubin novel. Sebastian is a preposterously winning fictional creation. He owes a debt to Randall McMurphy in Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, to Lionel Esrog, the private detective with Tourette's syndrome in Jonathan Lethem's Motherless Brooklyn, and to some of the motormouth talkers in Philip Roth's fiction. Sometimes the radio station in Sebastian's head is tuned to the dark, self-loathing feed that the writer Tommy Tomlinson has called You Suck FM. But more often, the songs emerge as delirious patter. He hopes to get out of the mental hospital where he's been placed after a dramatic episode and become an ambulatory schizophrenic whistling Carmen as he ambulated down the boulevards, a cane in one hand and a tuft of hair in the other. Tore adore, la-di-da, la-di-da. Sebastian was formed, in large part, on the anvil of childhood trauma. This is a quality that links him with Patrick Melrose, the protagonist of St. Aubin's best-known work, the five interconnected novels sometimes referred to as the Melrosiad, or, as the author prefers, the Melroses. Most of the resemblances between Seb and Patrick stop here. St. Aubin crashed right out of the gate with those wicked Melrose novels, in the same manner Karl Ove Knausgård did with his My Struggle series. Both writers have experienced what seems to be an identity crisis since those defining peaks. Each is a vastly talented novelist working out what kind of writer he now wants to be. For San Abin, one answer was provided in his last novel, Double Blind, published 2021. Among its subjects, I wrote at the time, were brain mapping, biochemistry, immunotherapy, schizophrenia, and the ethics of placebos. Parallel Lines is a sequel, oh no, to that novel. You don't have to have read Double Blind to swallow this one. The same large cast is here, caught up with a few years later, just after the worst of COVID. The setting, most of the time, is London. There are shrinks, people making radio programs about the varieties of approaching Armageddon, portentous light and land artists, a woman fighting cancer, a boy named Noah with an ark, estranged twins, a billionaire who is almost palatable despite what is called his belligerent hospitality, a priest or two, and an awful mother named, what else, Karen. The topics on the table this time, indeed this novel reads like bright table talk, include the nature of psychoanalysis, a form of literary criticism in which the text is the subconscious, patronage, compassion burnout, dietary virtue, developments in oncology, faith, coffee, dinosaurs, conceptual art, and Donald Trump as a sociopath and narcissist. The primary theme, however, is connection, synchronicity, surges of coincidence, twining, mirroring, whatever you want to label it, all coming together like a bride having her hair braided before a wedding. San Abin finds links and associations everywhere. Every corner of the known universe heaves with layers of meaning. San Abin is worth reading nearly all the time because his novels contain brutal and funny intellectual content. He's a briny writer, one who dispatches a stream of salty commentary, sentences that whoosh past like arrows. Making people proud of what they used to be ashamed of is such an intoxicating alchemy. She had a face like a court summons you'd scrunched up angrily and then fished out of the bin and tried to flatten. An unexamined life always commands the highest price for an autobiography. You can probably pick up an air defense system at Walmart in El Paso. Thomas dispatched the two Negronis with the relief of a man chucking a couple of overdue thank you letters through the slit of a post box. Wondering, as she always did, why Olive Oil was alone in having extra virginity. His men and women, most of them comfortably off, worry if the barbarism of the age can be redeemed while worrying about their own small boutique barbarisms. They are trying to save what's savable inside and out from a world on fire. San Abin's talents are mighty, so much so that you wonder why this novel and its predecessor aren't even better than they are. Parallel Lines is a high-level entertainment, but it's so incident and idea-packed that nothing quite sticks. San Abin can be as philosophically acute as Iris Murdoch, but unlike her fiction, you're rarely aware of the hull below the brightly painted watertight deck. Parallel Lines lacks a certain earthiness. You never sense the blood flowing under its character's hair. What about Sebastian? He's the primary reason to be here. He rips into the jam song, "That's Entertainment," at the least appropriate moments. He wishes that, like a cow, he could stomach anything. He calls his shrink of 5 years his psycho-nanny-list. Placed in the hospital suicide observation room, he comments that, with a name like that, you would have thought it would be stuffed with pistols and daggers and grenades and cyanide capsules. Even though he is fully grown, the reader half wants to adopt him. Like Shakespearean comedy, Parallel Lines builds up to a big coming together, this time in an art gallery with most of the major characters crammed into a small space. In the penultimate sentence, someone says, "to be continued." Are these novels destined to become part of a trilogy? I'd probably read a third one, but I get paid for this. The reviewer, Dwight Garner, is a book critic for the New York Times, writing about fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and the book world writ large. Murder in the Dollhouse, The Jennifer Doulos Story, by Rich Cohen. The book cover is pink, and there are four black squares arranged in the larger square. One of the squares has half of a face of a smiling, attractive woman. The reviewer is Lewis Bayard. Sex, money, and death in Connecticut? We ate it up. In Murder in the Dollhouse, Rich Cohen tells the story of Jennifer Doulos and our queasy fascination. On May 24, 2019, Jennifer Doulos dropped her children off at school in New Canaan, Connecticut, then drove home in her Chevy Suburban. She was supposed to swap out the Suburban for the Range Rover so that she could drive herself to a doctor's appointment in New York City. Only she never made it. In the wake of Jennifer Doulos' disappearance, suspicion fell on her estranged husband, Fotis Doulos, a builder of luxury homes, who was spotted on surveillance footage disposing of bloody trash, along with his girlfriend, described as an international party girl. Fotis, presumably to avoid criminal justice, poisoned himself with carbon monoxide from his SUV. His girlfriend is currently incarcerated. It was all a terrible and senseless tragedy, no question, and five children are now parentless in its wake. But what made it news on such a massive scale? Replace New Canaan with Hartford, the Chevy Suburban with a Nissan Versa, and the wealthy wife with a single mother struggling to keep her kids afloat, and ask whether Connecticut would have mounted its most expensive ever criminal investigation on her behalf. Ask whether her final hours would have played out everywhere, from the New York Times to Vanity Fair to Dateline NBC to a lifetime docudrama tastefully titled Gone Mom. I know, I'm being a true crime buzzkiller, but it is to Rich Cohen's credit that, in his never-boring Murder in the Dollhouse, he pauses over the media's obsession with dead white women and declares outright that the Doulos murder was about money. It's always about money. He proves his point over the course of his book, though you do have to get past some initial grandiosity. The more I learned, the more I felt as if I knew Jennifer, as if her world and mine were contiguous, he writes. I felt like I was seeing the story of my own generation in a convex mirror, distorted but recognizable. Maybe we can skip the mirror part and follow the cash, because therein lies the tale. And Cohen, a prolific journalist and author of 14 books, is awfully good at telling it. With great skill, he sketches the origin story of Jennifer Farber, who was the niece of Liz Claiborne and the beloved second daughter of a wealthy financier. Growing up in Brooklyn Heights, she was a child of privilege, eschewing the subway and bus in favor of a black town car. She never held a paying job, but she did like to write, and she enrolled for a time in NYU's graduate dramatic writing program. As Cohen tells it, she really just wanted a family of her own. She had spent a good part of her youth peopling a Victorian dollhouse, and the decor of her first adult apartment had included an empty baby crib. Still unattached at 35, she began to panic. Enter Fotis Doulos, a handsome Greek water skier, former Brown classmate, and Columbia-accredited financial analyst. He was also married, but that obstacle was soon surmounted. Burning to have children, Jennifer headed straight for an in vitro fertilization. Two sets of twins followed, then a fifth child, apparently unplanned. The money bleed had just begun, because kids in suburban Connecticut require babysitters and nannies, and when they get older, boat rentals, horseback lessons, lacrosse, and ice hockey equipment. When such families travel, they require first-class seats, five-star hotels. The financial solution offered by Jennifer's dad was to float his son-in-law millions of dollars in cash and guaranteed bank loans to launch a luxury real estate business. But then her dad died, the business floundered, and her husband's eye wandered, landing at last on a snow skier with a child of her own. By 2017, Jennifer and Fotis had separated, but this did nothing to ameliorate their financial woes because they placed their marriage at the mercy of Stamford, Connecticut, which, as Cohen writes, happens to boast the most punishing, money-friendly divorce court in America. Plunged into this zero-sum dystopia, the Doulases soon ditched their attorneys for expensive scorched-earth lawyers who justified their retainers with a sea of filings, more than 400 in all. 23 months later, their divorce hadn't even left the starting line, but Fotis, chafing at court orders he saw as punitive and staggering under millions of dollars worth of debt, had reached his breaking point. We might write off his ensuing act of homicide as the work of a psychopath. Cohen certainly does. But Fotis had no prior history of physical violence, and Cohen's own reporting suggests that if the Doulases had somehow managed to sidestep a divorce industry that monetizes revenge, they might have lived to tell their own tale. At least it's pretty to think so. In the end, a lot of people got rich off Jennifer and Fotis, and nothing got fixed. Her body has still not been found. The reviewer, Lewis Bayard, is the author of The Wilds and Jackie. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.